country. We appreciate you taking the time out today. We will talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Take care.
You're so welcome. And that's it for us, folks.
The end of 2020 is finally here. Couldn't come soon enough. But that means you only have a few more hours to help KBOO reach our end of the year fundraising goal on the Give Guide. Show your support right now by donating at kboo.fm/give. Every dollar you donate to KBOO on the Give Guide goes directly to us so we can continue bringing you volunteer-powered, community-focused radio. Donate before midnight tonight at kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Eddie Muller. Eddie Muller is the founder of the Film Noir Foundation. Eddie Muller has 3 books on film noir: Dark City, The Lost Worlds of Film Noir, Dark City Dames, and The Art of Noir. There are also 2 novels, The Distance and Shadow Boxer. And Eddie Muller introduces once a week noir films on Turner Classic Movies, TCM. And we're going to go into that in a little bit. But the reason that you're here now is because of a film that came out of your work in film preservation, which is a 1950 version of Richard Wright's Native Son, starring, of all people, Richard Wright himself, and it was filmed in Argentina. How did you hear of this film originally? Because when I first heard of it, my jaw dropped.
Yes, as did mine. It's actually a very interesting saga. And I want to preface this, Richard, just by saying that credit needs to go where it is due. I am involved in the revival of this film, let's say, but not actually directly involved in its restoration. That was done by the Library of Congress, so our tax dollars at work, that's a good thing. And there are many, many other people who took a long road to get this film back in circulation. And while I play a part, I don't want anybody to think that I'm the driving force behind the restoration of this film. But to answer your question, I do an annual noir festival in Washington, D.C., actually in Silver Spring, Maryland, the AFI Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. And many years ago, I'm going to say it was at least 10, perhaps more, I was approached there by a man named Edgardo Krebs, who is an anthropologist at the Smithsonian. And he was friends with a colleague of mine, Fernando Peña, who is in Buenos Aires. And Fernando had deposited a 16-millimeter print of Native Son at the Library of Congress. And he believed that it was the only truly complete version of the film, perhaps in existence. He had seen the badly edited version of the film, but this 16 print in his own collection, he deposited it at the Library of Congress in the hopes that they could restore it at some point. And that's what I saw. Edgardo sort of arranged, along with the AFI Theater, to have a private screening of the film for me. And that was, honestly, the first time I saw it was the first time I had heard of it. And making the occasion really surreal and unique was the only other viewer with us that day was Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, who was the former president of Bolivia who had worked on the film as the assistant director and had complete recall of making the movie. And now he is an ambassador, I believe, and was in Washington, D.C., and Edgardo invited him to the screening as well so he could clue us in on the history of the movie. So that's how I came to see it the first time. And the thing that got me involved is when the film was over and everybody looked at me and like, what do you think? I said, I think it's a film noir.
It is.
And that was sort of how my involvement began.
Speaking of film noir, I mean, I'm watching this and starting to think, much as you did, why am I watching this and why did I watch that introduction by Eddie Muller? Which, by the way, is excellent. It's, you have to see it before you see the film. I hope they show that when it shows up on VOD and TCM.
Kino will definitely show it when it's streaming on demand, but I'm actually doing an entirely new introduction for TCM with Jacqueline Stewart, my colleague at TCM, who is a cinema professor in Chicago. She's a specialist in silent film, but she also has taught Richard Wright at the university and knows quite a bit more about him as a man and a writer than I do. So it's a very good combo.
And that will be during Black History Month in February 2021.
Correct.
As you were speaking just now, I kept thinking, you know, it is noir. It is a well-known book, certainly. And as you know, there's a version in the 90s that came out. And a couple of years ago, there was a play version that I saw over at Marin Theater Company. So it's not exactly unknown, and it is a noir. Did you wonder why you'd never heard of it?
I quickly learned why I never heard of it, because of all the travails they had in getting the film distributed, especially in this country. I mean, the film could not be made in this country, and so that was the whole appeal, was the director of the film, Pierre Chanel, who is a Belgian, French-Belgian, and had directed a lot of movies in France in the 30s and 40s. He had fled Europe during the war years and relocated to Argentina, where he was making movies. But he had met Richard Wright in France and said, you know, we really should make Native Son. And it's interesting because Chanel was the first director to adapt The Postman Always Rings Twice as a film in France in 1939.
Yeah, let me interrupt you on that. Is that film available anywhere? I'd love to see it.
You have to really dig. I have seen it, and it's a fine film, not quite as good as Luchino Visconti's unauthorized adaptation of The Postman Always Rings Twice, Ossessione, that he made 3 years later. But Chanel convinced Wright that they needed to make a film version of this. And then eventually when Wright came to Argentina as sort of artist in exile, that's when Chanel and a producer named Jaime Prades put this whole package together. And the weird part about it was apparently the money was in place to make the film. Wright never really wanted to play the central character of Bigger Thomas, but they convinced him to do it. Chanel was very persuasive and said, you know, all you have to do is just live his nightmare. You wrote it, so how can you not understand it? Just do it in front of the camera.
But he was in his 40s and yeah. Bigger yes. is like 20.
Yes.
Bigger's a kid. Older people don't react the way Bigger would.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the, you know, flaws of the movie is that unbelievably, Richard Wright is not well cast as his own character. But my understanding was that they needed to make the movie when they had the window of opportunity to make the movie. And so casting Richard Wright became a viable solution lest they lose the budget. You know, and if you've read the book and your point is very well taken, Richard, that he behaves in a way that an older, more mature man probably wouldn't. But then again, I would suggest that if that's what you're focusing on in the movie, you might not be seeing the forest for the trees, you know?
It's not a particularly good film, but boy, is it interesting. It's a very interesting film.
You see, Richard, this is the challenge, right? We live in a culture where everything has to be the greatest thing ever made in order for anybody to pay any attention to it. And interesting and fascinating and compelling don't quite equal great. in our present circumstance. But I found this film to be utterly fascinating because the backstory of the film is as intriguing as the movie itself, and why the film could not be made in the United States. I mean, if you know the story of Native Son, it should be obvious that in mid-20th century America, not only are they not going to make the film, but you would never get wide distribution for a film in which a black man kills a white woman, it kills an affluent white woman, and covers up the crime. You know, I don't want to give away the plot if people haven't seen it or are looking forward to seeing the movie, but it is very much a noir. A crime is committed. There's a question as to whether it's intentional or whether it's an accident, and the system grinds this impoverished, poor black suspect into the dirt for this. And it's just his story of his life. And I think that Richard Wright did a very commendable thing in taking the spine of a crime story and writing a book that is a massive social commentary about the black experience in America. This is not an uncommon thing. Other crime fiction writers have done this quite often, but for Wright to do it and to be an African American was really something. But there was no way this film was going to get made in America. You know, they made it with the expectation that, well, we'll get money on the back end when we sell it to America. They sort of knew they weren't going to be able to go very far in the southern states with this film. But then they were shocked when the distributor just chopped the thing and took out all the politics, took out all kind, you know, and it just ruined the movie. So at least now we have the version that Wright and Chanel intended.
When I was watching it, I kept thinking so much of it is what we would call today on the nose about racism and about politics. But the eye-opening part, of course, is that in those days, the outright racism of many of the characters and the political underlay involving what is it, the Communist Manifesto?
Yeah, exactly.
None of that in 1950, really. And even the speech by the white guy, the white liberal, is something that you'd never have heard in those days.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's funny to me, you know, because I write so much about film noir, and that noir, original noir era coincided completely with the anti-communist hysteria and the witch hunt and the House Un-American Activities Committee. So when I watch the film, it's not just the stuff, the racial stuff, that I'm like, wow, this would never get by. It's all that, you know, the victim's boyfriend, who is obviously a communist sympathizer and an organizer and very radical, and he's got his tracts and his pamphlets, and he's trying to convince, you know, what should be a 20-year-old black guy of why he needs to join the party, because, you know, the man will never accept you, blah, blah, blah. None of that would have ever appeared in an American film of that period. Although I will say there were accepted racial subjects dealt with in Hollywood movies at that time. I mean, at the same time this was being made in Argentina, Joseph Mankiewicz was making a film called No Way Out at 20th Century Fox that was one of Sidney Poitier's first movies, that basically is about how a single incident leads to a race war in this small East Coast town. And it's a pretty strong movie. I mean, that's a tough movie for people to watch even today. So it wasn't like America was hands off, but Sidney Poitier had a nobility about him that made it okay. The subversive thing about Richard Wright's story is that he is presenting a very flawed protagonist. He's basically saying the system is so rigged against these young black men that he has absolutely no chance. And they don't try to give him any kind of false nobility. He's an angry young man in black skin. He is doomed just because of that. And that's sort of the point of the book. And they were never going to make that movie in this country in the 50s.
Also, Wright felt the need, I guess, to leave the country because he was under personal attack for being on the left. Is that right?
Absolutely. And he was one of a number of African-American artists of the 20th century who found life much more amenable for him in Europe and then for a time in Argentina, because he was not subjected to the same kind of prejudice that he found in this country. So he was, you know, hail the conquering hero when he goes to France and when he mingles with the arts community in Argentina. He was seen as a hero. Certainly, he did not get that treatment in his home country.
You're listening to an interview with Eddie Muller, who has been called the Czar of Noir. Right now we're talking about the film, 1950 film version of Native Son by Richard Wright, with Richard Wright. It'll be available in February on Turner Classic Movies, and before and after that, you can get it on kinonow.com. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. There was a recent article I saw by Ayanna Mathis about James Baldwin and Wright, and Baldwin had some very negative things to say about Native Son. Did they ever meet?
I don't know if they ever met, but it's interesting you bring that up, because it's very intriguing to me how these things go in the, for lack of a better term, I'll just say the arts community. How certain artists come into favor and then fall out of favor. There's no question that Richard Wright, the novel Native Son, was the landmark novel of African-American fiction and helped pave the way for Baldwin. But now the tables have entirely turned, and while Baldwin is getting his just due as this great American voice, for whatever reason, his negative comments about Wright have now cast Richard Wright in a very negative light within the African American community, arts community, and academic community, which I think is really kind of a shame. It's like, I wonder if this is a peculiarly American thing of like, which camp are you in? Which team are you on? You know, oh, I'm with Baldwin. Oh, no, I'm with Wright. It's like, why is it impossible to see both of these guys as artists in their own right working against the same prejudices and obstacles?
On the other hand, it's not like French film, let's say, in the 50s and early 60s didn't have those kind of splits. It wasn't a racial one, but certainly, you know, the rise of people like Truffaut, I mean, they put their noses up at the earlier films in the French canon.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a good analogy, and it's one, and it's something that has perplexed me for years, because, you know, they were against Marcel Carnet, and they were against Yves Allégret and Julien Duvivier, you know, and I shared those prejudices out of hand for no good reason. And then later on, you see Duvivier's films, and it's like, this guy's a magician. He's a cinematic magician. Why were they so against him? You know?
Bringing that back into noir, then, how did the French New Wave view all of those phenomenal noir films that came out in the 40s, 50s, and well into the 60s, things like Les Samurai?
Well, Jean-Pierre Melville, who made Les Samurai, is sort of an island unto himself. He wasn't really part of the French New Wave because he predated it, and he had his own studio. You know, he lived atop his own studio. He lived with his mother and his wife, and he just lived for movies. And obviously, you know, I think the younger guys, Jean-Luc Godard and Chabrol and Truffaut, I think they all admired him and looked up to him because he was so fiercely independent, and he just made his own movies in his own way. And, you know, the French, you know, they worshipped American, particularly American B cinema, I think because they enjoyed the resourcefulness that was evident in these movies that were made quickly and for not a lot of money. And I think they offered some guiding principles to the filmmakers when they were starting out. You know, if you watch Godard's Breathless, you can see him sort of imitating a lot of things that were in Joseph Lewis's Gun Crazy, where he's figuring out how to do this, you know, for a few francs. You know, instead of having tracking shots, he puts the cinematographer in a wheelchair and pushes him around the streets of Paris, and they, you know, they're getting the same effect.
What about a film like Elevator to the Gallows?
Interestingly, you rarely see that included in discussions of the French New Wave. It predates it a little bit. But Louis Malle was not considered part of that subversive movement. He was much more of a traditionalist. But it's just interesting because when you watch, if you watch Elevator to the Gallows and then watch Breathless, you see that they have so much in common. The young kids, the theft of the car leading to a crime. There's a great many things that those films share, except Godard takes a more innovative approach to using cinema than Louis Malle did.
Eddie Muller, last week I finally saw Rome Open City, Rossellini's film. That's almost a noir about the war.
Yes, it is. Now, and did you know that to make it even more noirish, my Film Noir Foundation, we publish a quarterly magazine, and a contributor to our magazine named John Ranovics did some amazing research and discovered that the American government was very much involved in the creation of those Rossellini films. The OSS, later to be the CIA, were helping fund those movies as part of the rehabilitation of Italy post-war. That was a big part of it, and I thought that was fascinating. But your observation is right. A lot of those neorealist films did have a noirish aspect. Earlier I had mentioned Visconti's Ossessione, and everybody refers to that as like the first neorealist film. I mean, predating Rossellini or De Sica's Bicycle Thieves, and that's a total film noir. It just doesn't look like what we know noir to look like, but it's The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's exactly the same story.
Before we move on, what influence does John Houseman's play of Native Son have to do with the film?
I think it has a tremendous amount to do with the film. I mean, Houseman and Orson Welles had staged a version of Native Son, a stage version, with Canada Lee playing the part. Even Canada Lee was a little too old to play bigger. Yes, the film version borrowed a lot of the same ideas. It obviously makes it much more cinematic than the stage play was. But there is that dream sequence in the film that I'm sure has corollary in the stage play. All the people involved said that it was a major trigger. And obviously, the stage play is how Pierre Chanel first came to the material. He saw the stage play before he had read the book and said, I would love to make a film version of this.
The acting, even from the other actors, isn't great, which is kind of surprising because the director should have done a better job. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. It just seemed that the acting was a flaw in the film, certainly not the design, which was great.
The design is spectacular. Some of the supporting characters, I think, are good, but yeah, there's a certain staginess to the acting that it's hard to get around. But I just go back to what you said earlier, Richard. It's a very interesting and fascinating film. When I saw it, my initial reaction was, this is an incredible missing link in cinema history. Because from the time I started writing about film noir and showing the movies, I was amazed at how many African-American fans older films have. This was an eye-opening thing when I joined TCM. And I would go and do the TCM Classic Film Festival and be approached by all of these black movie fans who love the old movies. And it was an incredible learning experience for me. And I would always say, what is it that you're getting out of these movies when you're not even represented on screen? Like, how do you relate to this stuff? And I had several people make a really amazing observation to me, which was, well, when you grow up black, you know that the system is arranged against you. And so if you want storytelling and you want entertainment, you learn to identify your avatar in these movies. The guy's not going to be black, but you're going to find the next closest thing. And so it's funny that a lot of people say, you know, they relate to Jimmy Cagney or they relate to John Garfield because that's the underdog character. And so it's amazing how many African-American movie fans I have met in the past 5 or 6 years. I'm not saying, you know, a handful. I'm saying dozens and dozens and dozens. As I go around the country and show films at my festivals or go to the TCM events, an eye-opener. It really was.
Eddie Muller, film festivals. This was your thing. Suddenly, along comes the pandemic. Now, the last film festival, Noir City, was in January and February of 2020, so it happened. What was scheduled? What was canceled? And you said just before we started that you did your first online festival.
Yeah, before the curtain fell, the COVID curtain fell, we did an international noir festival in San Francisco and in Seattle, and we got halfway through one in Hollywood, and then that was canceled. That was in early March, and the rest of that festival got canceled. We have festivals in Austin, Texas, and Boston, in Detroit, in Chicago. All of those got canceled. But then we also, for 12 years, we've been doing one in Silver Spring, as I mentioned at the start of this conversation. That's where I first saw Native Son. And because I have a great history and a very close collaborative arrangement with the AFI, we said, well, let's take this online. Let's do the festival online. And you know, obviously, those months in between, we never were quite certain what was going on. And then it wasn't until later in the summer that it was like, we're not coming back anytime soon to live shows, you know? So we did it online, and it was quite successful. It was wonderful because people who've always wanted to attend one of our noir festivals but couldn't just because of the logistics, right? They finally could just join online, and we tried our best for, you know, out of the gate to sort of simulate what makes our festivals unique. I did an introduction, or a colleague of mine would do an introduction to every film to provide some context, and I did a live streaming Q&A at the midway point of the festival so people could ask about the movies, and it was good. And we will do it again, I don't consider it a substitute for the festivals, theatrical version of the festivals, but very much a complementary aspect to it.
What have you got planned coming up? Anything?
Yeah, absolutely. We're working on it right now. I hesitate to say like what the program is going to be because we're at the point where we're trying to figure out, this is all new territory, Richard. This is all new. And one thing that made the international version of the festival come off sort of without a hitch is that a lot of the films were coming from entities that had no qualms about sharing this stuff online, having it streaming. We were showing some very, very rare films from Germany and from Italy and South America. And the owners of those films were happy. You know, like, you want to show the film? Oh, that's fantastic, you know. They didn't know they'd ever make any money with it ever again. That attitude will change when we try to show movies that are owned by studios in this country, because they're all trying to figure out how they can maximize their profit. And, you know, in some cases, it's like they expect too much, and in other cases, they expect too little, because it's like, well, you know, we're not going to really make money with that, so why would we even bother? And it's like, well, because I can bring you thousands of people who will watch it. Is that reason enough? It amazes me in this country how often people just bail on an idea because it's not going to make enough money. It'll make money. It just won't make enough money.
Eddie Muller, so Native Son is going to be on TCM in February as part of Black History Month. People need to check that one out. And VOD in January. That's on kinonow.com. Do you have any books coming out? Any stories?
I do. I'm very excited. 22 years ago, I wrote my first book on film noir, Dark City, The Lost World of Film Noir. And I'm very happy to say it took me a long time to get the rights to that book back. But I finally did. And now a new revised and expanded edition of that book is coming out in the summer of 2021 from Running Press.
You've been listening to an interview with Eddie Muller. And again, Native Son will be on TCM in February and Video on Demand in January 2001. That's on kinonow.com. and for more information about Eddie, and also a number of essays about noir and other subjects at eddiemuller.com. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
I've just always been into drawing. It takes tons of time to come up with a character. And then eventually it was Pepe. It's a happy little frog. You like drinking and hanging out. It became Boys Club.
It's one of the funniest comics of the last 10 years.
Feels good, man.
That was the frame that started it all.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about the power of comics art, and more specifically, the power of memes. We have a filmmaking team with us, and they've directed a documentary for Independent Lens. It's a profile of cartoonist Matt Fury, the creator of Pepe the Frog, and it's called Feels Good, Man. Arthur Jones and Giorgio Angelini, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Oh, thank you for having us. It's great to be here. Yeah.
Well, let's start by familiarizing our audience with the artist, Matt Fury, the subject of your documentary. He's hardly a household name, but when you mention the character Pepe the Frog, then people take notice. What can you tell us about Matt's comic series, Boys Club, and the catchphrase, Feels Good Man, that made Pepe the Frog a sensation?
Yeah, so the name of our film, Feels Good Man, comes from a very specific reference in a series of pretty obscure comic books that started out as homemade zines in the mid-2000s. It's called Boys Club by a Bay Area artist named Matt Fury. And Matt does these kind of like stoner comics that all the characters are these anthropomorphic animals. They look a little bit like deformed Fraggles or like something kind of from the Muppet universe. And he'd done a series of four issues of Boys Club while he was living in the SF Mission and working at a thrift store called Community Thrift. And in issue number two, there is a six-panel, basically gag comic where Pepe the Frog, which like I said before, is this anthropomorphic kind of frog creature, is in the bathroom and he's got his shorts pulled all the way down around his ankles and he's peeing into the toilet. And one of his roommates walks in without knocking and surprises Pepe. And then in the final frame of the comic, his roommate asks him, well, why do you pee with your pants pulled all the way down around your ankles? And Pepe says, feels good, man. And that's where this whole weird story starts. And then from there, our movie charts, you know, Matt, who is this like underground cartoonist, you know, very much in the same world as like R. Crumb and the Furious Freak Brothers and other comics that were made in the San Francisco Mission. And then Pepe gets sort of kidnapped by the internet with none of Matt's doing and becomes this wildly popular internet meme that gets remixed and redrawn by thousands and thousands of people all over the world. And then in 2015, Pepe gets weaponized. He gets turned into a hate symbol and used by the Trump campaign and some of their social media. And so our film talks about both Matt and who he is as a comics creator and also just how the internet has sort of like... you know, can sort of pull apart and attach meanings to things in all sorts of unexpected ways. And then it was also just really about this 2016 election moment here in the US where trolling moved off of these message boards where Pepe was very popular and into mainstream politics. It's about the aesthetics and tactics of trolling.
And what you're bringing back to the screen here to show viewers is the guy behind Pepe, Matt Fury, is he an innocent? Is he naive? Is he complicit? You know, and then you find out Boys Club, his comic, it's an alternative comic, but it's good-hearted stoner humor. There's nothing pointed or political about it. And like you said, Pepe the Frog gets kidnapped away from his four animal housemates, Andy the Dog, Brett the Rabbit, and Landwolf.
Well, Brett, it's hard to tell what Brett is exactly. Brett might be a bear. He might be a short-eared rabbit. It's kind of hard to tell. Yeah. I don't even know if Matt knows what Brett is.
Well, this documentary could have been a super serious look at the alt-right and neo-Nazi movements and how they're always trying to make it impossible for us to have nice things. But, you know, instead, you opt for a much lighter touch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's when Arthur told me about this project that he was working on with his friend, Matt Fury. I was aware of Pepe as the character, but was quite embarrassed to find out that there was actually this whole other backstory to it. But as he was telling me about Matt's plight, I think that's initially why I got so excited about the potential for the film, because it was something that Arthur and I had been talking about a lot, sort of in the backdrop of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, and the way the media was kind of handling this conversation, we thought was leaving a lot on the table for opportunities to improve, right? Like there was this moment where people like Richard Spencer were almost being lionized in a sense. And the beauty of the story is that it allowed us to tell a really dark and difficult story to tell, but with a kind of important reverence and humor that kind of, I would hope, opens people up to having this more difficult conversation. And of course the animations were like a really important aspect to that as well. Because the thing about making a documentary film, especially ones that tend to be more didactic or more political, is that, at least from our perspective, you don't want to like be preaching to the choir in a sense. You want to make something that is hopefully effective at communicating something to the people that you hope to kind of change, right? And there's something disarming about the way humor operates in general, but certainly in the way that this story afforded to us. So yeah, we thank Matt and Pepe for that opportunity.
You know, Matt is not like a sanctimonious or pretentious kind of person. There's an irreverence to his comics, and it's a good-natured irreverence. But we felt like that the movie needed to tackle these bigger issues in a very straightforward manner, but we needed to do it with the same sense of irreverence that Matt's comics sort of came out of, because we thought that would give the film legitimacy and also kind of take it out of the standard kind of like documentary format. We really thought that Pepe gave us this amazing opportunity to make a film that kind of transcended genre a little bit, that we could really kind of have our own stylistic kind of take on it. And as a cartoonist, I was just excited to make a film that was really about the potency and power of cartoons. Cartoons are often something that's like dismissed in culture so easily, but they're so important, and they're a part of the fabric of our visual language. And so Giorgio, I could take all the things that we were fascinated with, but still have this story be about this silly cartoon frog. And it was something that we just became obsessed with for a 2-year period making it.
The beauty of the film, I think, for us was figuring out how to ride that line between the absurd and like the deathly serious. And I think that's what makes it such a compelling watch. It's not every day you get to tell a story like this. And so it was a really excellent experience.
You're not above winking at the audience at moments throughout the film. There are moments when you're covering toxic shows such as InfoWars with Alex Jones, and then you would just dissolve the scene into video noise, for example. And then there's the heroic walk of the legal team that you filmed in slow motion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I was kind of talking about earlier, is like, we didn't want the film to feel precious. Like, it was so embedded in it, it was just the rampant absurdity of it all, that it was very important to capture that in the spirit of the film, right? And so like these winks are sort of moments for the audience to be aware that like we are also aware as filmmakers of how ridiculous all this is, but that nonetheless you must take it very seriously, right? Like no one wants to be in a lawsuit with Alex Jones, much less Alex Jones himself, right? Like that's part of the wink we're showing to the camera when we have that scene, that sort of shootout at the OK Corral scene between Matt and Alex Jones. It's like Alex Jones himself didn't want to be there, right? He's shows up late. He's like stretching, pretending like he just came out from a workout. Like that dude hasn't seen the inside of a gym since high school. But that is what trolling is, right? Like there's you have to pull the rug out from under it to diminish its power. You have to make fun of it and ridicule it for the farcical nature that it is. And so on a kind of meta level, that's what we wanted the film to feel like, because as a piece of media literacy, we'd hope that people can watch the film and really come away with a kind of understanding with how the way the world is working, how to engage the internet as an almost explainer, an emotional explainer for how to engage the virtual world, which I think has been something that society has been having a hard time dealing with, right? And that's kind of what I think 2016 demarcated for us. It was this moment that the internet subcultures and irrealities that were forming online suddenly spilled into real life. And I think for a lot of people in society, they had a hard time understanding like why things were happening and why things were playing out the way they were and weren't able to kind of connect the dots from these obscure message boards to real life. And of course, now we have things like QAnon, which are probably like the most visceral examples of that kind of experience. And so, yeah, these winks and nods are kind of, I think, really important moments for the audience to understand that, like, almost like an exercise in understanding how to deal with trolling.
You interview a surprising number of unsympathetic people who seem perfectly happy to say horrible things on screen.
Yeah.
Among others, there's a very shady Trump operative by the name of Matt Brainerd, mm-hmm. and a young man named Mills who literally lives in his mom's basement posting to 4chan all day.
Yeah. Those are two characters who are acutely aware that the camera is in front of them and running, right? They're people who almost play characters on the internet, especially in Mills's case, so much so that he kind of doesn't know when to turn it off. And so as documentary filmmakers, it was a really challenging shoot and edit in figuring out what authenticity really meant and how we rendered their characters, right? Especially in Mills's case, that was something that Arthur and I talked about quite a bit, was how to tell his story authentically without both like giving his more kind of toxic ideas a platform, but also understanding that his real truth that we were kind of driving towards was what is behind in a society that like encourages and allows someone to spend sort of 12 to 18 hours a day sitting in their basement on their computer doing something that in Mills's case is like completely aware is bad for him, but he like keeps on doing it, right? Like, so that was the emotional truth that we knew we had to get out of him, regardless of whether or not he was performing 100% of the time that the camera was on him.
Memes are an important part of the theme of the film of Feels Good Man. You talk to a surprising number of academics and theorists. There's author and psychologist Susan Blackmore. She's making some heavy pronouncements about biology and culture to explain, you know, what people are seeing on the internet and social media.
Yeah, Susan wrote a textbook in the late 90s called The Meme Machine. And it's still being taught, I think, in like semiotics classrooms and that sort of stuff now. And she's an acolyte of Richard Dawkins, who wrote The Selfish Gene, and he coined the phrase meme. And he was trying to figure out basically like a word that sounded like gene, but wasn't, but it was talking about like basically how culture sort of moves from generation to generation, from population to population. And for him, it's this sort of like gene level view of biology that I think has largely kind of fallen out of favor within the world of academia. But this notion of memes as like a unit of culture that sort of travels around and captures people's imaginations and shapes our reality has now really become kind of newly potent in the internet age.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking about the film Feels Good Man, a profile of Matt Fury and of his character, Pepe the Frog. Joining me today are documentary co-directors Giorgio Angelini and Arthur Jones. I want to foreground Matt Fury because this is something the film does. Feels Good Man, the movie, really seeks to let people know about the creator behind Pepe the Frog. And in the film, you see Matt as he's struggling with what's happening to Pepe. And he's seeing more and more racist and toxic uses of the character, and he starts making appearances at Anti-Defamation League events. He starts rallying his fans to counter all the hateful memes and create happy, loving Pepe memes. So at first there's a big outpouring of support, but then, you know, the hate groups come charging back even harder, and the ADL ends up labeling Pepe as a hate symbol. There seems to be nothing that Matt can do to change their minds at that point.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Matt is a very analog person. So as Pepe was sort of getting handed off from subculture to subculture on the internet, Matt wasn't necessarily paying attention to all of this. Pepe was something that also Matt drew in his mid-20s, and he had kind of moved on from. There's a part of Matt that I think had left Pepe behind, you know, in 2010 or 2011, and he wanted to move on with his life as a fine artist, as a father, and kind of leave the world of Boys Club behind. He was coming out of his own basement, you know. Matt is also someone who has a very kind of San Francisco live and let live kind of attitude. And I think that was always even expressed in Boys Club. I think there is a part of Matt that doesn't want to tell anyone what to do ever. So the idea that Matt would have to enforce his copyright was something that was kind of a painful process for him. People often talk about Matt as being naive, and I usually want to push back against that because, one, the situation with Pepe has never happened to anyone else before, ever. And there's no real clear roadmap as to how to do it. Like, how would Matt have reclaimed Pepe? Would it mean like him writing emails to every single anonymous internet troll that was using Pepe? That doesn't necessarily work. He didn't have the finances to have copyright attorneys help him before it was declared a hate symbol. The irony is that it kind of had to get out of control before he could find attorneys that were willing to take this on pro bono because they knew they could get great press coverage to help Matt. You know,
well, but just to be clear, it's not just to get great press coverage. They're lovely people. It was just they saw it as like a really important opportunity to defend copyright in this like particular moment, and like it had to get that weird for them to like, yeah. Anyway, they're very lovely people, is what I'm trying to say.
They totally are, and they've been collaborators with Matt. They've been more than attorneys. They've been collaborators in the process. But, you know, they work at a big law firm that has the infrastructure to take on a certain amount of pro bono cases a year. So, yeah, I didn't mean to make it sound like they were opportunists because they definitely aren't. And they were disturbed by all the same stuff that Georgie and I were disturbed with post-Charlottesville, and they wanted to make a political difference in the way that they could as intellectual property attorneys. Matt, though, gives you a very specific kind of lens to see how the things that people do in the vacuum of the internet actually do have consequences in the real world. That the ripple effect of you using Pepe on 4chan does actually affect someone who has a life and a reality. And I think hopefully when you see Feels Good Man, you will have like a certain kind of empathy for people out within the sort of like beyond the confines of your screen. There's like a butterfly effect to Pepe that we thought would be powerful. You know, and that was something that Matt is also someone who is a true pacifist. And being a true pacifist means that you're constantly sort of placing yourself outside of kind of confrontation. And that in itself kind of becomes a problem sometimes. So in Feels Good Man, you see him decide to sort of like get off of his couch, come out of the basement, and tried to take on something that was so out of control that he had to do something, even though that was uncomfortable. And we think that that's like a potent message that anyone can kind of feel attached to.
Yeah, Matt Fury, he's clearly uncomfortable in this situation of enforcing a copyright on his character, on Pepe. And he's sort of the antithesis of Walt Disney. You know, he's... He's happy to let other artists play around with this creation. But when it becomes clear that this is, it's gone beyond play, it's gotten into terrible harm, this is where he reluctantly goes to this big law firm. He's sort of pushed into it by his friends. At one point he says, I'm an artist. I don't like suing other artists.
Yeah, I think that was the point, is that like, I think that those early days, right, when Pepe was really just being used as a innocuous reaction meme, I think that did make a lot of sense. It was probably, I know for sure for him, it was like kind of a novelty to see this weird internet world taking his creation and doing legitimately funny things with it. Like it was probably a very weird, but like delightful thing to experience. But then as that trend morphed more into like the professional racists actually using it, and more specifically, people then like actually trying to make money off of Pepe, right? Like the people that Matt sued or his lawyers sued on his behalf were people who were trying to monetize his creation. So Alex Jones literally used an actual tracing of Matt's Pepe for a poster and sold thousands of those posters for profit. Like Richard Spencer, like literally used Pepe on his website and was actively trying to associate his alt-right movement with Pepe, and was like that famous moment that we use in the film, but I'm sure everyone is familiar when he gets punched in the face. He's just literally describing the pin that he has on his lapel, which is of Pepe. The journalist is like, who's that character on your lapel? Because at that point, people had been kind of registering this connection. And he's like, oh, this is Pepe. And like, whack, he gets punched in the face. Like,
yes, that was the highlight of Inauguration Day 2017.
Truly.
Exactly. So, you know, Matt does hate suing other artists. I would argue that he still has not sued any artists. He's just suing assholes. So he's still free and clear of suing actors.
And also just Matt kind of hates politics. Like he sees the farce in politics. I mean, after this last election, someone sent him like a Biden Pepe and he was like, why can't this end? He doesn't see why Pepe should be used as political propaganda ever. That's just not what Pepe means to him. That's it, full stop.
The Boys Club books, they go back many, many years, started in 2006. More recently, and we see this in the film, Matt became a family man. He's a dad. He's published a children's book called The Night Riders, which is a wordless story about a frog and a mouse exploring their landscape on a dirt bike, riding through forests and seaside, meeting dolphins and bats. That one, it manages to be both gentle and kind of psychedelic.
Thumbs up Matt, right? Yeah, I mean, he's gentle and psychedelic. That's who he is as a person. The thing that I love about Knight Riders, and you know, there's a turning point in Feels Good Man. Like the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, for Matt is when a guy self-publishes his own kid's book using Pepe, and it's this Islamophobic, racist kid's book. That was the moment that Matt kind of couldn't take it anymore.
What was it?
It was called Pepe Impede, and it was made sort of as like a piece of MAGA propaganda, like self-published MAGA propaganda. And if you kind of take Matt's book, Knight Riders, and you take Pepe Impede and look at sort of become like the contrast of the culture divide in America, Pepe Impede is really about xenophobia. It's about anger and keeping the other out. It's about misinformation and resentment. It's about exclusion. And Matt's book is about inclusion. It's about all these different animals from different places in the forest coming together to have a shared experience. And I think ultimately it kind of is like a very telling illustration of where we're all at. And at the end of Feels Good Man, we want people to kind of understand that they have a choice. They can turn the internet off and participate in reality and truly sort of understand that we're all here for a short time on Earth and we have to figure this thing out together. And I think that's ultimately kind of the simple truth of Knight Riders and the simple truth of our film. And I like the way you described that book. I think it's true to Matt, and I hope that, you know, Matt will now as an artist feel free to make more kids books and make whatever he wants to make, because there was this moment where people really kind of assumed that Matt was Pepe for all of the evil baggage of Pepe. And Matt, as an artist, wasn't really able to do the things he wanted to do because people would just sort of see whatever he was doing and assume that it was negative. For a period of time, people thought Matt might even be a neo-Nazi or something. And so hopefully after you see Feels Good Man, you'll at least understand Matt as a person and have like a greater appreciation for like who he is as an artist and realize that if Pepe can change, we all can.
Now, you're not looking for easy resolution, but there is a hopeful note towards the end of the film. In Hong Kong, Pepe the Frog has been adopted as a completely different symbol, a pro-democracy freedom fighter. One person explains it by saying, it just looks funny and captures the heart of so many youngsters. It's a symbol of youth participation in this movement.
Yeah, that was a real surprise for us as filmmakers. I mean, it felt like a deus ex machina when that happened. We were prepping the film to try to go to film festivals, to try to get into Sundance. And that happened. And it was super surprising, but also does speak to just how Pepe means different things to different people all over the world. While Pepe was officially being designated a hate symbol in the United States, it was simultaneously an extremely popular character in the world of gaming in places like Korea and Malaysia and Singapore and Hong Kong. And so, you know, that was something that we as filmmakers could never have guessed that was going to happen when we started the project, certainly. And I think it does give the film some legitimate hope at the end that, you know, it was very moving for us as a film crew. Yeah. Giorgio, you have anything to add?
No, it was beautiful. It was just like, it's something that Matt had been saying from the minute we started filming with him, is like his belief was that like Pepe will change, like it's going to always change. And so don't like confine it to this idea that Pepe is a hate symbol. Pepe is everything, right? And then all of a sudden this Hong Kong stuff happens and it like completely validates everything Matt had been saying. So it's
yeah. And I will say, like, I mean, the Hong Kong protests, it's interesting. The protesters saw memes as a very powerful tool for themselves to get their point across and to get their point out into the rest of the world. Pepe was used as a meme. There was this Shiba Inu dog that was used as a meme. They used this cartoon pig as a meme. And in part, they were using memes because the Chinese authorities had this facial recognition software that meant that everyone who was protesting had to wear a mask. And so once again, Pepe became the symbol for the anonymous aggrieved person. And in the case of Hong Kong, it was because a woman got her eye shot out with a non-lethal round. And the next day she showed up to the protest with a handmade sign, and it was a picture of Pepe with his eye shot out, wearing a construction hat. And that photo was picked up by the Western press, and Pepe became a part of the constellation of symbols that were used in their protest moment.
Wow. Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Kanzer, and my guests today have been filmmakers Arthur Jones and Giorgio Angelini. They're the co-directors behind the documentary Feels Good, Man, about cartoonist Matt Fury and his character Pepe the Frog. Arthur and Giorgio, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for having us. This is
awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, now for our listeners who might be interested in your work and in Matt Fury's comics and children's books and all that, how can they find out more?
Yeah, so we self-released the film, actually. PBS was kind enough to give us our TV premiere, and I'm not sure if it's actually still up on their app or not, but yeah, encourage you to check it out there. That is a TV edited version, so if you want to see the unedited version, the director's cut, I guess you would say, you can rent it on Apple or Amazon or wherever you rent films. And our website is feelsgoodmanfilm.com, and Matt Fury's website, I think it's mattfury.com, right?
Yeah, and Matt's actually started a Patreon, so if anyone is moved to support Matt, they could donate to his Patreon. And he's working on a new book about dualities, and then he's also kind of starting to think about another kid's book. So I would follow him on social media and look out for what he's doing. So, and he's doing an art show in, I think, 2022 that he's pretty excited about.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, yes.
Well, thanks again, gentlemen. Thanks also to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. And thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. And a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
Supported KBOO Portland. Do you love volunteer-powered, community-funded radio? Then join the thousands of individual supporters who make KBOOP happen. We only have until December 31st to meet our end-of-year fundraising goal. So donate today at kboo.fm/give. That's kboo.fm/give.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 31 de diciembre del 2020 se han recuperado y sobrevivido al COVID-19 más de 59.107.000 personas en todo el mundo. En Brasil más de 6.707.000 y en México más de 1.066.000. Hay más de 83 millones